from St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking. Hi, everybody. This is Jason Rosenbaum, a political correspondent with St. Louis Public Radio. The rise of Donald Trump as the leader of the Republican Party ushered in a new wave of populism up and down the ballot, both nationally and in Missouri. And while Trumpism arguably helped the GOP's electoral fortunes over the last couple of election cycles, it also repelled a lot of Republicans who disagree with the GOP presidential nominee's approach and policies. Former Missouri Senator John Danforth is part of a new group called Our Republican Legacy, which looks to reassert, quote, traditional Republicans against the lurch towards populism. And the organization is hoping to provide a national resistance to Donald Trump's ideology and approach. Earlier this week, I talked to Danforth about his new group and what he hopes to accomplish with it. In addition to serving as U.S. Senator, Danforth was also Missouri's Attorney General and the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. This is my conversation with former Senator John Danforth. What prompted you to get involved in Our Republican Legacy, and what do you think it will functionally do to change the ideological direction of the Trump Republican Party?
America has benefited from having a responsible conservative party. It doesn't have that anymore. The Republican Party, at least in its dominant iteration right now, has gone very right-wing. It really isn't conservative, very far out. There's an angriness about it, really a meanness of spirit about it. And it's the opposite of anything that I was ever a part of. I mean, I was in elective office 26 years as a Republican, 8 as Attorney General, 18 as U.S. Senator. And I was never a part of anything like the current situation, which is the opposite of the party of Abraham Lincoln, the opposite of the party of Ronald Reagan and the Bushes, Eisenhower, everybody who went before. There was really Republicans differed on a lot of specific issues, but there was a consensus, really a uniformity of belief and fundamental principles that held us together as a party. And now each one of those principles is its head. So it's an effort to restore the Republican Party, and not just looking back to the past, but also for the future. I think America needs a responsibly conservative party, which is uplifting, which is positive, and which tries to hold America together rather than drive us apart.
I think one of the really interesting things about this group, and it's mentioned in the Washington Post op-ed, is this is not a lobbying organization. It's not a super PAC. You're not trying to prop up a third-party candidate this year like No Labels attempted to do but decided not to do. Why do you think not taking those approaches will help you reach your goal of turning the party away from this Trump populism that you and your other former colleagues decry in this op-ed?
America has a long history of being a two-party country, and third parties have not fared well. Independent candidacies have not done well. So we are a two-party country. And when American politics was able to function, we had a lot of overlap between the two parties. We had a center-right party, which is the Republican Party, a center-left party, which was the Democratic Party. There was a center in American politics. Now that center is basically gone. It's been obliterated. Republican Party for sure. And if the Republican Party is not competing for the Senate, the center, but only trying to energize the base, the people who were the most ideologically extreme. Then that frees the Democrats to turn to the left, which I think they have done. The center is pretty much gone. So if we can restore a Republican Party that's responsible, that's centrist, that appeals, as Lincoln said, to the better angels of our nature and not to these feelings of resentment and hostility, then I think that would also have a positive effect on the Democratic Party and a positive effect on American politics and on really on the American psyche.
Could you make an argument that this drive to the center has been rejected by Republican voters 3 presidential election cycles in a row? Like, I understand, like, they weren't going to dump President Trump in 2020 when he didn't have real opponents, but there were some candidates this cycle who were trying to appeal to the political center who didn't really get traction within the primary system. What would you say that those results speak volumes about the ability for your effort to be successful?
There's been no real pushback. There's been no resistance. And that's what I've found talking to a lot of Republicans. I know that they've kind of given up, and they have not done a good job of presenting the clear differentiation between the right wing and conservatism. And those differences are very real and very strong and very principled. But you have to present voters with that choice. It's possible to be a Trump Republican. It's possible to be a Reagan Republican. But the two are not compatible. They're inconsistent. It's really impossible to be both at the same time. And I think that it's important for those of us, and it's really the principal mission of our Republican legacy, is to make that contrast very clear and to make the point that where the party has turned just in the last 7 years is a reversal of fundamental principles that we have stood for really 170 years.
Well, I want to go through some of these principles in this op-ed, including the first one, which is the Constitution. The senators who wrote this op-ed, which includes yourself, former Maine Senator William Cohen, and former Wyoming Senator Alan Simpson, said, quote, "We think January 6, 2021, the date of the mob assault on the Capitol, was one of the darkest days in U.S. history, and the events leading to that assault were direct attacks on our constitutional order." The person who precipitated that mob attack, Donald Trump, is going to be the nominee again. So the start of the editorial talks about how Republicans are struggling about what to do here. If that's the core, one of your core principles of your group, doesn't that basically say that, like, Republicans who feel repelled by what happened on January 6th have really no choice but to vote against Donald Trump in some fashion, whether it be voting for Joe Biden or writing somebody in or voting third party?
Our focus is not on an individual election, and it is not even on the 2024 election specifically. It's long term. It's what happens after the 2024 election. Where is the Republican Party at that time? And so we are putting the question to Republicans. Now, a lot of Republicans really are in a quandary. They don't know what to do in this election. I know them. I know a lot of them. Some of them are going to vote for Trump just because they think that it's the better of two bad choices. Some of them are going to sit it out. They say, well, I'm just not going to vote. Some of them are going to vote for Biden. I mean, I know people in all three of those camps. So there really is a Republicans wondering where to go. And a lot of people just they're almost desperate. I mean, for example, in Indiana, 22% of voters in the Republican presidential primary voted for Nikki Haley. Now, that was after Haley dropped out of the race. So it was really a protest vote. These people took the trouble to vote, took the trouble to go to the polls or vote absentee, whatever they did, in order to register an opinion that they were still Republicans and they didn't agree with the current direction of the party and they wanted something different. So that's the nucleus of the people that we're appealing to. And it's a little bit like building a snowball. You know, we started with three of us. That was Simpson, Cohen, and me. And then we built it. So when we made the announcement last week, we were over 30 of people, very prominent Republicans, including a former vice president, including a former Speaker of the House of Representatives, former chairman of the Republican National Committee. Those people were all added, plus numerous members, former members of Congress, former senators, and this thing is going to build. So what our hope is and our belief is that as far as the MAGA group is concerned, this too shall pass. It is too contrary to basic principles, and it's just too ugly and negative to be sustainable.
Your op-ed says, "We stand against divisive tactics of both right and left that divide, quote, us against them by exploiting emotions of grievance and rage." I certainly understand what you're saying there, but I just to play devil's advocate, if I'm a voter who's really passionate about an issue, let's just say abortion rights, and I think on either side, whether you're against or you're for them, and I see my opponent as somebody who is taking a morally reprehensible position, is there any way to avoid that us versus them mentality when you have certain issues that are going to be in the public discourse, which seem to be driven by the emotion that you're decrying in this op-ed?
In our group, our Republican legacy, I know of people so far in our group who are pro-life. I know people who are pro-choice. They have very strong views on that. And yet they, despite their differences on something that's a very big issue, they come together on basic principles. And one of those principles is just holding the country together. So when what's happened in American politics today, both right and left, identity politics, I mean, it's certainly true on the left. It's us against them. It's the oppressed versus the oppressors, as far as the left is concerned. It's everybody's picking on me and the deep state and all that, as far as the right is concerned. And it's treating your opponents as your enemies. They're not your enemies, they're simply your opponents. That's the only way politics can work. If you treat your opponents as though they're enemies and everything is just a huge issue of unreconcilable differences, then you have the constant warfare, the polarization that now exists in our politics. I can't imagine anybody who was a Republican, whom I worked with, now that was a long time ago, but I worked with a lot of Republicans. I can't imagine anybody saying in a speech, "I am your retribution." I mean, imagine that. I am your retribution. This, elect me, I am your retribution. How does that square with Abraham Lincoln? How does that square with Lincoln saying, as the country was breaking up, March of 1861, seven states that already seceded from the Union, Lincoln said, we are not enemies, we are friends. We must not be enemies. I mean, that really is the first principle of the Republican Party, holding us together. And it's become quite the opposite now. It's become grievance. It's become victimization. It's really unbelievable. I mean, I turn on the TV and I see Trump standing outside the courthouse and he plays the victim card. He's the victim. Here's a man who's a multi-billionaire, lives in an estate, flies around on his private jet. Oh, we're supposed to feel sorry for him because he feels sorry for himself. That's what politics has come to. And it's certainly true on the right and is certainly true on the left as well, where it's the whole business of the oppressor versus the oppressed.
Is part of the solution here from a broader, like, social solution standpoint, just maybe talking to each other more and having empathy for our disagreements? Like for example, if Republicans were to talk with African Americans who feel very strongly like the country has done them wrong for centuries, like using the law to make them second-class citizens, if they just had these conversations, do you think that there would be less of an us versus them mentality and there would be more empathy for each other's perspectives?
You bet. That's exactly what I think. It's important to cross lines. It's important to say to all Americans, African Americans, poor people in rural areas who are very angry right now, it's important to say to all of them, we are one country, we are one indivisible nation, and to reach out to them. It's certainly true in politics. I mean, I spent 18 years in the Senate. It was very important. I had just as many Democratic friends as Republican friends, social friends, and people who joined together in bipartisan efforts in legislating. I think breaking bread with people who are different, just sitting down for a meal would be great. You know, take a Republican to lunch. I think that is very key. I think empathy is exactly the word for it. Being able to put yourself in the other person's shoes and understand what the other person, even if you totally disagree with that person, at least you're treating him or her as a human being.
On the last three principles, before I get to a couple more questions about the group and the people involved with it, it involves like curtailing spending, pushing back against tariffs, and also quote unquote peace through strength, which means supporting countries like Ukraine, which are trying to repel aggression from Russia. I guess, again, to play devil's advocate, what would you say that, at least for the second two of those three, that maybe Republican voters just disagree with those views that you are counting as principles for your group? And then when I say these views, I mean free trade and a more interventionist foreign policy.
Well, what I would say is on free trade, people, both Trump and Biden have turned the other way on free trade, but it was certainly a basic Republican principle. Ronald Reagan would be turning over in his grave if he knew that a Republican presidential candidate was proposing 10% across-the-board increase in tariffs. It would have a dramatic and negative effect on our economy. You're concerned about the cost of living today, just wait until there's a 10% tariff on everything that's imported. And then we get into a trade war and people in rural America are having a hard enough struggle now. Wait until there's a trade war. So, the question is basic Republican principles on which everybody agreed. I mean, like right across the board, from very progressive Republicans to very conservative Republicans, all of them would have agreed on the non. It's bigger than just trade. That's a big part of it, but it's essentially, the question is government intervention in the economy to an extreme extent. And that's what high tariffs are. The foreign policy? Yeah, well, I mean, a majority of Republicans in the House of Representatives voted against aid to Ukraine. I can't imagine anybody I served with voting, any Republican I served with, voting against aid to Ukraine. And even worse, Trump's inviting Putin to invade non-compliant NATO countries. I mean, there's such a difference between Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, and Mr. Putin, have at it. That's what we've come to. So what our group, our Republican legacy, intends to do is to hold up the sharp contrast between fundamental principles that existed and we think could exist and what's happened to our party today.
We're talking with former Missouri U.S. Senator John Danforth about the new group, Our Republican Legacy. I want to turn to Missouri for a second, because I'm a big Missouri political buff, and I know that the concept of populism has been popular at times in Missouri, and I'm not just talking about now with Josh Hawley or with Eric Greitens or Ed Martin in the last 10 years, but I'm talking like Champ Clark, and I'm talking like Charles Lindbergh, and I'm talking about Champ Clark's son, Bennett Clark, who were all populist in their own right and anti-interventionalist and kind of anti-free trade. Do you think that there's something about, and I know you don't fall into those categories and you were elected statewide multiple times, but is there a certain level of public support in a state like Missouri for political figures that have populist edges to them?
Well, I was around, as I said, for 26 years, and I certainly did not see that. I didn't see that among Republicans with whom I served. Kit Bond, for example, he was certainly just standard Republican. Tom Eagleton, with whom I served in the Senate, I would not call him a populist, but these were people who made politics work. I mean, politics could function in those days. And it could function because their people were not just constantly picking at sores and making people angry. The idea of politics was to appeal to independents. If you're a Republican, only way I could get elected was to get a lot of Republican votes and also a lot of independent votes and some Democrats to vote for me. The only way I could do it. Now it's all the primary elections, and it's all making people angry because those are the people most likely to vote in the primaries.
I'm sure you remind Jay Nixon that all the time about how you got a lot of Democrats and independents to vote for you in 1988, correct?
Every time I see him. You know, he's my law partner and he's a great guy. I like him a lot. And talk about somebody who works politics in the best sense of that word, namely, how do you get results? How do you push your basic philosophical views, but at the same time within a system? That's what he did. I did run against him, and I always remind him of how that election turned out so that we have fun together.
That is fun to look at a map and see that. You know, I look at some of the people who are involved with this group, like former Speaker Boehner. I read his book. I know of just how difficult it was for him to be House Speaker with this insurgent Tea Party that was nipping at his heels all the time. But I guess, like, some Democrats would point out, like, he wouldn't have been Speaker if he hadn't have cultivated this Tea Party wave. I know that all the people involved in this have probably supported people or supported views that they probably regret in hindsight. But I guess my question is, like, do some of the old Republican Guard have any responsibility for sowing the seeds of this Trump populism that you see today? Or do you think that this is just a completely, like, invasion of the Republican Party by something that came from out of nowhere?
It's sort of a both and. I mean, if you're in politics and you try to win elections, and you certainly don't go out of your way to alienate groups of people you think would vote for you. But do I think that this is new? Yes, I think that this is very new. I think the Trump phenomenon, the MAGA phenomenon, is very new. It's had a very short life, about 7 years, 8 years, something like that. The Republican Party has existed for 170 years. I think that it is very, it's not just different. I mean, if it was different, that would be one thing. It's the opposite of what our party has been and what our party should be. So, yeah, I do think it's an anomaly. I don't think it can exist. I think in the next election, if Trump loses, he would be viewed as a two-time loser. Even if he wins, I think he's going to overplay his hand and become even more disreputable in a second term than he is now, and I think he'll lose his audience. So I do think that this too shall pass.
Josh Hawley is on the on the ballot for re-election. I know what you've said about him in the recent past, that you regret supporting him. Do you think that his re-election could be a referendum on whether Missourians reject the populism that you're decrying? Or is, like, other things that may be out of their control, like whether people vote in Missouri for Trump or whether national parties support the Democratic opponent, those may weigh more than whether people like that type of populism that you're decrying.
I had hoped that a Republican would run against Josh in the primary. That didn't happen. We've become such a red state that I suppose winning the primary is tantamount to getting elected. I don't know this Kuntz. I guess he's the most likely Democrat. From what I do know about him, he seems to be kind of a left-wing populist as opposed to a right-wing populist. So there's sort of a circle that's gone around on that one. So I don't know. I mean, I think, from my standpoint, and like so many people that we mentioned in the first paragraph of that op-ed, it's very difficult for me to go to the polls. It will be next November. And I kind of know what I'm not going to do, but I don't know yet what I'm going to do. So it's very, very difficult. I don't know what the election, I doubt that it's going to be decisive as far as the populist thing goes.
That's a good point, because you are correct that Kuntz is also striking a populist streak. So unless there is, like, a libertarian or a Green Party revolution in Missouri, which we both know from the start of this conversation isn't going to happen, it seems like Missouri voters who don't like that type of brand of politics are kind of stuck between two similar, not similar ideologies, but similar approaches. I see populism as an approach more than an ideology, simply because you can be a left-wing populist and a right-wing populist. And I guess maybe to scale it back a little bit, again, I know this group is not a pack. You're not going to be trying to convince anybody who to vote for. But, like, I guess to put it counterintuitively, if a bunch of populists on both sides of the aisle win in 2024, it seems like the goals of your group are going to be more difficult to achieve.
Well, our goal is going to be the same. It's to try to restore balance to American politics. It's try to restore the Republican Party to the really positive party that it has been, and to the contribution that it's made in a constructive way to American politics. That's going to dip regardless. And I think that sooner or later, we're going to regain our equilibrium. A lot of people say, well, this 2024 election is existential. I don't really see it that way. I see America as basically a strong country. I see it as a country that wants to restore its equilibrium. I see the American people as people who want to live together and not just constantly have the red flag waved in front of them, you know, as though, you know, all these politicians, they say, I'm a fighter. I'm going to elect me. I'm going to go to Washington and fight, as though we don't have enough fighting going on now. And I think that most people, and I do believe I know my state very well. I certainly have lived in it all my life. I think that the people of Missouri are just good, decent people who wake up in the morning, go about their business, live decent lives, have their jobs, their families, whatever they're doing during the day. And the idea that every time they turn on the television, they see these raging maniacs screaming at them, saying, please, leave me alone, you know? And so I think there's a basic decency there, and I think Lincoln was right. I think that the job of people in any public voice that they have, and particularly in politics, is to appeal to the better angels. And the better angels are there. It's just exactly what Lincoln said. The better angels of our nature appeal to that and hold America together.
You can read more of our coverage of the 2024 election cycle by going to stlpr.org. I'm Jason Rosenbaum, and thank you for listening. Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.